And I think we often, as humans, we get our hands on new skills before we, long before we know how to use them without causing harm.
Hello out there, and welcome to this episode of the SACS podcast. And hello, Bavo, how are you doing today?
Hey, Torsten. Morning. I'm doing good. I think this is the episode with like the furthest away guest in kilometers from where we are. It is also 8 a.m, so I'm happy I have my coffee.
Yeah, at least for us, because our guest today is Damien Lutz from the other side of the world, from Australia. Damien is one of the initiators and drivers of the life-centered design movement and also author of the books The Life-Centered Design Guide, Future Scouting, and, well, his newest and latest book, The Non-Human Persona Guide. So with no further delay, let's welcome our guest. Good morning, Damien.
Good morning, good afternoon, depending where you are. Hello, Thurston and Barbo.
Yes.
Thanks for having
me. Thank you so much for joining us today. And, well, since before we dive deeper into life-centered design and your journey into design and all these things, we would like to start with our SACS friendship book, a tradition that we started and that we do as each of our guests to know a little bit more about you. And well, since it is at least here pretty early in the morning for us, is how does a perfect day for you start?
A perfect day, yeah, ideally would be I would wake up refreshed from a really good sleep and then run down to the beach and have a run and a swim, and there would be waves so I could get a little bit of a body bash in and then have coffee and breakfast before starting
work. Do you go surfing?
That would be ideal. Not so much anymore because I don't live close to the beach now, but that's how when I used to live near the beach, then I would do that all the time, and I still dream of doing that daily, but maybe once a month I get to do that.
Nice. Yeah, as someone who doesn't live near a beach and lives in the middle of a city, read slab of concrete. That sounds pretty good to me. Yeah,
so that'd be nice.
As a follow-up question, we spend a lot of time behind computers because we're all designers, right? But what is your favorite place away from the computer?
So that would be the ocean, for sure. Because I was born near the ocean and lived most of my life seaside. And I just feel really energized from jumping in the surf. That's where the four elements meet. You know, you've got the water, earth, you've got wind, then you've got fire from the sun. So it just feels like this really special place. So as often as I can, I'll get down there and just recharge.
Nice. Do you have a favorite beach? I mean, you have so many beautiful beaches down there.
Favorite beaches are, like, Sydney's nice, but I'm from Queensland on the Gold Coast, and they're a lot sort of longer and straighter. So they're kind of my favorite ones, and maybe just a bit nostalgic because that's, you know, that's where I was born and lived. Nice.
Trying to avoid not to get too much into the ocean and into the surfing discussion, and where we could do this for for an hour now, I might say.
To bring Chris in and then we'll talk surfing. Yeah.
So you are a book author, and what's your favorite book, actually? Do you have a recommendation for our listeners?
I probably don't have one favorite book, and it will just depend on what I'm reading at the time. But I guess the book that comes to mind is actually, it's called Supernature. It's from 1973. And it was written by Lyle Watson. He's a scientist, and he applied like the rigors of scientific investigation to more unexplainable things like auras and plants. And one thing that he did was to measure a plant's reaction to things. And he kind of, I can't remember if it was through temperature or maybe a chemical production or something, or the communication to the cells. And he could get these reactions from the plant by doing things to it. So someone came in and cut off a leaf, and then if that person came back into the room, there would be a measurement of a reaction. And they couldn't really sort of prove it or anything, but I just remember that really stuck with me, that plants, you know, just because they didn't communicate like us, they may still communicate. I think it was long before, like now we kind of know that they communicate through their roots, but that was just like a really different perspective on nature, and it really stuck with me. And then, yeah, I find myself I used to write some science fiction. I'd write about stories about androids communicating with plants. And now I've published a book on how we can understand plants and nature's needs and then, you know, protect them. So that's, I've just rediscovered that book lately and I'm tripping out on the connection. So that's why that's sort of a front of mind book at the moment.
That's a read.
But it's interesting read from 1973.
So apart from books, do you have, when we talk other mediums, like, is there a favorite movie that you prefer?
Yeah, same again. Like, I probably don't have one favorite, but do love science fiction. The Fifth Element, that was just, you know, it was so outrageous in its style, but it was so consistent. It was, you just wanted to believe this world existed, and a beautiful story too. I think that, yeah, definitely one of my favorites. When you get good sci-fi, like good styling, good world building, and some depth to the story, love nice. It.
Well, and I also liked it. Yeah. That's its relation to the core elements of the world, right? That's
yes, that's right. And that the fifth element is love, I think.
Well,
yeah.
That's a good way shifting towards what we want to talk about, which is sustainability and all its mm-hmm. different aspects. And it's one question we always ask, because I think there are so many answers. What is sustainability for you personally?
It's a challenge, you know, because I feel like so many of us on the planet, not all of us, but we've wandered so far from it. And so I think it's a challenge to get back, something to get back to. But then it's, you know, only half the story, because I believe we also need to regenerate. So to me, sustainable is like having enough for each season for whatever you're doing. And then, but regenerating is giving back to the mm-hmm. things we take from. So it's like half the story.
Could you give us your personal definition of what the word sustainability means to you?
Oh, okay. Yeah. So yeah, I think it's about having enough, like for each season. So making sure that what you don't take too much, and there's enough for something to keep itself going, mm-hmm. whatever you're taking from. What do you think? How do you define it?
Well, so since at the SACS network, we base much of our work on the sustainable development goals. And so mm-hmm. what I, for example, find really important is that it has so many aspects, not only on an ecological level, on a climate level, but also on a social and societal level, right? So mm-hmm. for me personally, so something I very often say is like, what have we won if we save the world only for us who are lucky enough to be born in a rich country in this world? We have to.
Or as humans.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we have to save it for all beings on this planet, right?
All life. Yeah. I totally agree with that. But it's kind of the same thing. If you, what we're taking from might be a human resource or a community. And so that needs to be able to sustain itself. Yeah, I mm-hmm. totally agree with the
all life. Yeah, for me too. I think I define it as the end result of an equation that tries to calculate the balance between all actors mm-hmm. of a project.
Nice. That I like that, because that kind of says you can get some metrics.
And yeah, there's multiple. Like, yes, we will use a lot of energy because we're creating a new tool. Like, how do we offset that? How do we balance that with other actors, social, human, nature, planet? Profit is one of them. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of finding the end should be a green number or a zero, never a red number. Then you can consider yourself sustainable. Mm-hmm. You might burn a lot of energy doing it, but if the end result is a net positive or an equal, then you can consider yourself sustainable.
Yes, and it's a word we should only use when something is fully sustainable. I think we often apply it to things that are doing some things to make themselves a bit planet friendlier, but they're not mm-hmm. actually sustainable.
We look at only certain aspects, right, and not at the whole thing. We don't take the mm-hmm. holistic view onto something, but we just we as society just pick one thing and look at this and say, okay, yeah, we're doing something here or we're doing something there, but do we get overall into the right direction? Do we make progress overall? I think this is what does not happen too often.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what's the bigger picture? How's it all?
And that's why I like connected. The Sustainable Development Goals, because it's a pretty good starting point to get an idea of, okay, these are all aspects of sustainability, and whatever we do, we have to consider these things, because all of these somehow belong together. And that leads to the next question, which is, do you have a sustainable development goal, or which is the sustainable development goal that brings out the strongest passion in you personally?
Well, that's a good question, because a few of them do, but I think the one that really strikes me is reduced inequalities. I think, like, as a white male in a financially wealthy country, I'm very privileged, and I'll probably actually never realize just how privileged I am. But then as a gay man who grew up in the 80s, 90s, I also know marginalization. So I know what that's like. And it just seems we can just be so cruel to each other. And it just seems so unnecessary. And I feel like it just could be such an easy thing to, not easy, but it's such a, if we fix it, it would have a lot of impact. But having said that, there's this book called The Pluriversal Dictionary, I think it is, and it's kind of a cry from the global south about how the SDGs are a bit too development focused, and they've got these values of what kind of a pluriversal goals could be, and they actually offer an alternative to sustainable development goals. They're goals that really kind of align with the same things. It's no hunger, it's making sure everyone lives above the foundation level, but it takes the development aspect out of it. So I think that's really interesting as a possible alternative. It means that, okay, any country could apply these goals, and if they want to add some development to it, they could. But for the countries that don't want to have constant growth, they can use these.
It's true. I was about to say, like, it is still very growth focused, right? Using the word development, as in we're building something that wasn't there yesterday. I'm like, well,
yeah.
So just make that circle nice and round, and maybe not grow.
Yeah, and it's, because we've got this argument about degrowth versus green growth, and I think my favorite one of these alternate goals is simplicity and enoughness, which is really different to constant growth and green growth. So I think that is a very important thing for us for many of us to learn and think about into the future, is simplicity and enoughness, as opposed to a constant growth. Doesn't mean you can't have both, but I like it as an option.
Cool.
Are you maybe speaking about growth, right? Are you more of the group of people who says, okay, we need to go into degrowth, or are you more of the group of people who says, let's go into green growth, circular economy? I mean, this. Mm-hmm. What's your opinion there?
Yeah. It's a really good question. There's a really great video by Olivia Lazard who talks about the impacts if we just suddenly go switch and create all this renewable technology, and the incredible impact it will have by getting all those materials out of the planet and then all the production. So there's an argument against, and just, growth has its limits, I guess. But I think I'm kind of trying to not get caught up in this like absolutes all the time, like this or that, because it turns us against each other. So maybe there's something in between where we degrowth a few things and other things can grow. And again, if you have these alternate goals, some areas can grow and others, have simplicity, enoughness. But then I think if you future think that kind of in the long run is that, some things can't just keep growing constantly. Perhaps they have periods of growth and then they flatten out. Maybe there's something, solutions in between.
I like the point of the polarization that you bring up, that it does push us more towards polarization. And I've been thinking on this, it's more and more present in my mind, of like the circular economy. don't get me wrong, as much as I'm a big fan and I really hope we crack that nut and can retrain companies to become circular. At the same time, it is a pretty privileged position to say to other people, like, no, you can't grow. We have for the last 500 years as Western, you know, richer countries. We've been growing thousands of years, but you developing countries cannot. And it's like, again, finding a balance is going to be a challenge there. Because yes, you will need growth. And some countries, think of Africa, they need to undergo an immense amount of growth and are doing so actively. Who are we to say, no, you shouldn't, it should be circular, while most of our economy still is growth based as well. So I've been struggling a bit with that concept lately.
It's all about decentering ourselves, isn't it, from our position and knowing our context. A lot of times we thinking of solutions are not really kind of, it's from our, when we talk it like from our, from our world.
Yeah, I think what you point out very well is that there is most often there are no easy answers, right? There is not this or that. There is no, this is right, this is wrong. There is, it's always about finding the best way in the middle somehow. And that makes this whole thing into a better future so complicated. Mm-hmm. And because,
Yeah, because nature's complicated. Yes. It's not, isn't it? It's not.
Yeah,
this or that.
True. So, to get back a bit to where we were, we've been talking a lot about humans, and we know humans to be flawed because we're all corruptible, and we're no different when we deal with sustainability. And one thing that we really want to emphasize in this podcast, we do this with all of our guests, is we're not perfect either. We all cheat the system. We all sometimes do things we know we shouldn't. We've been starting to refer to them as guilty pleasures. And we're wondering, do you have a guilty pleasure when it comes to sustainability? Like the one thing you know you shouldn't, but you still do?
Yeah, I've got a few. It's hard to adapt. Daily coffee without my reusable cup is a small thing, I guess. I got into food delivery with COVID. Like I would never get food delivered and that forced me to do it. And it was almost like it kind of broke my discipline, and then I would use it a lot. And I don't think it's a great thing. You know, just that getting meal for, cause I live alone. So all that energy to deliver one meal to one person, it's not good. So yeah, I still do that at times, but yeah, COVID time was like, oh man, this is so wasteful and great. It was definitely a guilty pleasure.
But you know, that's why we asked this question, because as Bavo said, right, we all have these. There is, I guess there is no one who does everything 100% right. That's what makes us human.
Yeah. No, I'd like to meet the person who lives a 100% sustainable life. I don't think that person is born yet.
Yeah. And I think it's a good point. And like, no company is going to be 100%. As long as we're always improving.
That's the thing. We need to improve. Yeah, yeah. How can we get better until tomorrow, next month, next year, right?
Yeah. Keep that, you know, we're sort of always improving on the incline.
Thank you very much, Damien. That was the Sucks Friendship book. And so you're
an
approved friend of Sucks now, we could say. And so let's jump more into your journey into UX and especially life-centered design. But to start this up, how did your journey into design and UX actually start? How did you get into that?
So I was always very creative. My creativity was started with painting, really large canvas paintings, and multimedia. You know, I'd just sort of stick wire into the canvas and get very tactile with it. But I soon realized that wasn't going to pay the bills. So I ended up moving to Sydney and doing a course in a master's in design science to like futurize my creativity. And from that, I moved into graphic design. And around that time, UX thing was very, very new. I don't think there were any courses here. So I had to learn from a couple of books and then apply it to freelance work and develop skills that way, which then led me into actual UX roles. And then I would complement things like skills with sort of short courses, etc. And that's so then I've been in digital design since about 2010. Yeah, mainly like B2B things like telecommunications, whether like lots of different industries, but very much for I guess customer facing apps and websites. And then my last year or so has been with government roles, which is really different again. It's more sort of systemic, and it's good at satisfying a sense that it's helping people and mm-hmm. particularly vulnerable people. So that's a nice change to using from using design to just sell things. So it's, yeah, it's a good satisfying sort of work at the moment.
Right. Cool. Since you've been around for so long, what do you currently see as like the biggest challenges design, let's take design as a whole, is facing?
Design as a whole, I think it's just stuck in the growth and sell, the profit and sell mindset. I think it's, and it doesn't have, some, it needs to have like accessibility and inclusiveness and ethics embedded by default. They don't seem to be a part of design schools. Like mm-hmm. there's lots of sort of small businesses that pump out designers, UX designers, but they don't get that foundational aspect. So it's kind of perpetuating this use of design to sell and just to make profits, not really getting that chance to mm-hmm. think more broadly. So I think it's probably, you know, bigger, it's just slow it down a bit. Try to have a bit of a mind shift about the impacts of design and think more broadly with it.
I really like when you said it's about resetting defaults, because that's also something that drives us mm-hmm. a lot, right? So if we would say what's the mission of SUX, it's making sustainability, responsibility default in all of our processes, instead of having it as an extra in the end where someone says, now we need to add some more sustainability or responsibility. And so, yeah, highly relate to that actually.
Yeah, very true. I remember like in working a few previous roles and accessibility was mm-hmm. a bit of an add-on and you can see sustainability is having that same phase. I think accessibility is a bit more embedded. Talking to younger designers, they're a lot more aware of it and they seem it's almost to consider mm-hmm. it by default. But sustainability is I guess it's next to get it embedded. I see you worked on the web sustainability guidelines. So that
Tim
should
Frick started this and
definitely help.
We are working towards making this a standard in the W3C. So let's keep our fingers crossed actually.
Yes. The goal is
yes.
The goal is for the European Union to adopt them pretty quickly, like they did with the accessibility guidelines. They're now mandatory. The web, mm-hmm. is it 2.1 that we're on right now? So all public companies in Europe must abide by the 2.1 WCAG guidelines. And we're kind of hoping to just deliver them like, here's the sustainability guidelines.
Yeah.
Yes.
Here's the appendix, yes.
So that's kind of the goal right now. So obviously you've written a few books. One of them is Life-Centered Design. And now that we're on the topic of design, maybe this is a good point to also, could you in a nutshell explain to us what life-centered design is and why you decided to switch your focus more towards that?
Sure. For me, and there's lots of different interpretations of life-centered design because it is really emerging. So it's emerging design practice that expands human-centered design to also consider the needs of all the animals and environments and invisible users that our mm-hmm. projects impact, with a greater goal to nurture or foster a world where all life forms thrive.
Yeah.
I think this is so important, getting further than these human-centered design approach, right? Focusing only on the users and humans, but mm-hmm. on all actors, being it human or non-human, that are impacted by the products and the experiences that we build. And that's maybe one of the big flaws of all of our tools, is that they are built to focus on the user, right? By by default. And that's maybe one of the biggest shifts we need to take, that we get away from focusing only on users, but by default, having all actors in mind that are impacted by what we build. And maybe, what would you say? I think people like us, we are sort of in a bubble, right? We talk with other people who also work on this field. There are many more people out there who do not think so much about this. What would you say, where are we on this journey? How much more, or how much further do we have to go, right? So what's the progress at the moment?
Yeah, I think you made a good point. We're in a bubble, you know, and it's our silos, our social media silos. I just hear everybody talking about this thinking now, life-centered thinking, more than human thinking, sustainability. But then some, you know, I'll talk to someone that, or I'll post something and get a response. Oh, I've never heard of this. And it just reminds me that I'm in a silo. So it's really hard to judge. It's definitely a movement happening. And I think with the, what was it, Massive Action webinar last night with Bruce Mao and his group, bringing their energy to it. So, and calling it life-centered design. And that's definitely, which sustainable UX is a massive part of. That's kind of a significant moment, I think. So while it's still got a long way to go, it's, I feel like before, like talking to some people, they were like, what is it? Is it a trend? Is it a movement? But I feel like now it is, I guess you'd say it's a trend now. It's definitely embedded and got some traction.
Yeah, I agree. We see it furthering and furthering every single month. There is more buzz, more people, bigger communities. We also notice it in the amount of people that come to us with questions. The biggest question, and I also want to show this to you. So you have a website, lifecentered.design, which is full of practical tools and methods that people can use. Where do you usually advise people who come to you and say, how do I get started? What's the best thing to pick up first? What's my step one?
For digital designers. Yeah. You could, on my site, there's a really simple introduction. It's under Get Started. It's Sustainable UX. It's just a really simplified introduction of the different aspects to it. I think actually practical app starting, there's some tools you don't need that are already built. You don't need to replicate, like Echo Grader. So you can put your URL in and it tells you, it rates the sustainability and the accessibility, few exits of your pages. And it has all these sort of tips on how to improve it. So it's a really good starting point to set a benchmark and start learning. And then looking at sustainablewebdesign.org for their actual sustainable web strategies. I think they cover it just so, so well. Other things that I could add to it is, I think we need to incorporate more behavioral design. So I've done a bit of research into that. And I've created a guide, which is also on my website, how to apply behavioral design in e-commerce to help people choose more planet-friendly options. And it's just really a starting point. It's looked at all these different approaches and created some best practices as a starting point. So I think, behavioral design, because that's another aspect where we can start getting users to act sustainably and bring them more into the conversation. And ethical design, just make sure we're not using dark patterns, etc. And non-human personas or non-user personas, start exploring how to use them to represent. It's tricky for digital because you don't have like a physical product that you can see how it's directly connected to what part of nature, but you can start thinking about what are the taking a systems view, which is part of life-centered thinking. It's, if your website is a digital product, it's part of the digital technology industry. So what does the digital tech industry impact? What human, non-humans and non-users? And you could create personas for them and start thinking about how to use your business, your website, your influence to reduce impact heal them.
Speaking about the non-human personas, and I already named at the beginning, there is the brand new book, which is the Non-Human Persona Guide, which can highly recommend mm-hmm. to all of our listeners, because what I like really about your books is that they are so packed with practical tools and information. It's stunning, really, really mean that. Also, so you could say I think your book was released beginning of this month, right? So we're recording in September now. And then
yes,
1 or 2 weeks later, Apple did this, the keynote with this video where Mother Nature visited Apple and talked about their progress in terms of sustainability and climate. And so a non-human persona was used by one of the biggest corporates of the world. How did you feel about that? That Apple was using non-human personas on their biggest event of the year, actually.
Yeah, I don't think we should call it a non-human persona, because I feel like that was a bit more entertainment and character, you know, sort of a characterization. And it just worries me a bit that it might dilute what a non-human persona is, which is a method and a tool. And the method part mm-hmm. is really, really important, because that's where you create it and that's where you develop the empathy. It's where you learn about the parts of nature and the invisible people that we can so easily ignore with our sort of current system in the Euro-Western developed world. So I think what they've done is a characterize, and it was really good. Like, it was really entertaining, and the things they shared is really inspiring. It does make me wonder about what they're not achieving and what is the bigger picture. Like we kind of mentioned at the beginning of this talk, what's the bigger picture? How does what they're doing balance out the negative impact? It's hard to imagine that any business could, that's taking so much from the planet and creating so many different products and shipping them all over the place, is not having some major impact. So I don't want to, like, I think it's great what they're doing, particularly with, I think, their influence to inspire the conversation and other organizations. That's awesome. But yeah, I do wonder what the bigger picture is. And but I think essentially it was great that they kind of brought nature into it. It's not a non-human persona from my perspective. It's more kind of a...
Mm-hmm. I do want to say, like, thank you for bringing it up, because there's obviously a lot of talk, and the following sentence will be cut out. That's why I'm pausing. I have not seen the video. Okay. Still, I have not seen it. but one thing that does, and I hear a lot of voices for, I hear a lot of voices against, and everyone is talking about it. But that's the point. Like, one thing Apple achieved that no one else so far in the world mm-hmm. has achieved on the level that they just did, is people are talking about it. Because you can be for or against, mm-hmm. but suddenly sustainability is a topic we are discussing en masse globally. And whether it's well done, not well done, leaving that in the middle, they did achieve a feat, I feel, in making us talk about it.
I think that's the point. For me, it was sad to see how much they left out. So what are about other things they do or do not, right? So it was sort of greenwashing, because they're putting all the good things to the front mm-hmm. and not talking about, I don't know, working conditions, or still it's impossible to change the battery of your iPhone, etc. Yeah. Right. So mm-hmm. expanding the lifetime, which has a huge impact, actually. But I think it helps so much, as you both also said, with the narrative, right? So before, when we go somewhere and talk about non-human personas, you could come to people that have a little, I don't know how to say that, a little smile on their face, right? Haha, a persona about a bee. That's funny. And now you could say, yeah, but see, it's like mm-hmm. Apple does. So it's helping people like us with...
Yeah,
yeah. Because the amount of times that I've sat in meetings with companies and I say, which companies inspire you? What do you want to be? Apple is usually one of the companies that mentions, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So there is that. There is now a precedent to talk about sustainability. That doesn't mean that we have to not be critical about the messaging and what was said, what wasn't said, is it greenwashing, not greenwashing. We do need to look at this critically. But at least there's now precedent to talk about it in boardrooms, which is something they've clearly stated.
Yeah. And even though it was entertainment, it was good to show that you can represent and nature have nature actually as a board member, like Patagonia mm-hmm. has done. Like, they've just brought it up to that level, which I think was really great. I do wish a company like Fairphone, which is that modular phone, and they really focus on fair work conditions along the supply chain, I wish they would get as much attention with what they're doing. I think someone suggested Apple should buy them and embrace it, and get them into the ecosystem as well. But yeah, look, it's a multifaceted conversation. And as you said, it really, really got people talking. Mm-hmm. So that's a really good aspect. And I think what we're saying before is, like, no business is going to be perfect. So they don't have to be perfect, but then they should talk about the whole picture. And then I guess, yeah, because they did make a real point of we're doing this, then you need to balance mm-hmm. out with the whole picture, I think.
You work with all these things for quite some time now. And what would you say when you introduce your frameworks, your tools to other people? Let's say, for example, non-human personas. How often does this work pretty well? And how often do you still, how to say that, look into more critical faces and people have question marks over their heads? So how much convincing work do you have to do still on introducing these methodologies?
So I'm really sharing them with other designers who love it. So there's mm-hmm. no resistance there at all. But having talked to other people, there's a company that I spoke to and I talk about in the book called And Us in the UK, and they work through Europe. This is a really nice story about how they started to introduce non-human personas to their clients. Based on something, they mentioned something about, our product kind of adds to the circular economy, and they just thought, look, about that, we could use a persona for nature to just explore how else the product contributes to circular economy. Just kind of kicked off that conversation, and then they're looking at how to sort of just use that as a BAU tool. And the client responded really well. They want to do it all the time. So I think it's just a matter of experimenting, finding ways to bring in the conversation, not really fully imposing mm-hmm. them, but looking for opportunities and sharing them. As designers, you can maybe want to create one in your design team, but then share it with the business. And I think a key thing is try to take them along the journey, because that's creating these personas. As I said, that's really where the empathy is created, and people start to sort of really connect. But yeah, I think they're really new. This is why I really did all this research and testing and interviews to understand this as a tool and a method, and what are the strong points. We haven't been around long enough for us to really understand their impact, good or bad. So I think it's really important we just try around, experiment with them. I think that their real strength is we can use circular design and sustainable UX to reduce our energy and impact from our designs and our products, and so we wouldn't throw away our life. But when you create a non-human persona, you're really focusing on a certain aspect of nature or humanity that you're really going to help and improve things for. And that's where the regeneration starts to come in, because that's when you go wider than just thinking of design. It's more about how do we use some of our profit and some of our influence to start making things better and healthier and more resilient for these aspects that we impact. I think that's the real strength, and that's a lot more exploration to go. I think they've got a lot of potential, but I think we just also need to be wary as well. The fact
that isn't really it maybe new. Also about, I think what I really like about all these tools is they are very helpful in creating transparency about the negative impacts of the products we build, because I think we still need a lot of this. We need to create this transparency to have a basis for conversation and discussion with stakeholders, because that is missing so often, right? These other actors are so often, they are not part mm-hmm. of the equation mm-hmm. at all. They are just not visible at all. And that's why I like these things, because they give for example, nature or animals or whom or whatever, a seat on the table that we are missing so far.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it just seems like such a simple, beautiful way to use personas. Like, it's a new version of our tool. Monica Schnell, she first introduced them, I think, to the modern design world anyway, in one of her articles in Medium. And it really just blew my mind. It just made me think, I really, really want to understand this and get it around and share it with other people, mm-hmm. and see what they do with it. But yeah, very interesting new version of an old tool.
True.
Yeah.
What would you say? I think we talk a lot about, and we talked about that before, about changing narratives, right? And changing defaults. And I think that's a big thing for all that we do, and changing, let's say, sustainability and responsibility. So creating responsible products from an extra thing that costs extra money, which is still the narrative, I think, to, it's not only mandatory for the future, but it's also, well, it's also mandatory for and good for business. So how can we get, let's say, better on changing, or how can we help changing this narrative? Because I think there is still a lot of work to do there, and creating this transparency is an important aspect of this. But I also think we need to get faster on this to convince the business side of the products that we build. Do we have an idea how we can get better there, or faster, or make more progress?
It's a good question. This always comes up because I think the biggest barrier is mm-hmm. time and budget. You know, if it doesn't get time and budget, it's going to get cut out. But I think I kind of have a very positive attitude, and I like to think that if every digital experience could make a few impacts, and there's things you can do as a designer without getting approval. You can just start implementing accessible and sustainable web strategy straight away, and you just start sharing that with your team and grow it out and get a bit of, you know, find allies as well. I think start with allies rather than banging your head against a brick wall. And if we start small and we just do what we can with our influence, that's how I got into this. I was just really sick of banging my head against a brick wall, and I thought, what can I do with my time and my influence? And then if you think about, if every single digital product or project did a little bit, that would compound, you know, just like we have compounding climate change effects that create these dangerous tipping points, we could have positive tipping points just through this compounding mm-hmm. impact. And I do think that the more we talk about it, because even the people in management and business, they're human beings and they'll have kids. Eventually at some stage, there's just going to be enough people talking about it, and on the side of it, that will start to mm-hmm. shift things.
Yeah, it comes back to that. People inherently aren't evil, right? I firmly believe that, even though a company might be, the people who are in that company are still humans at the end of the day and not inherently evil. Mm-hmm. I have no idea where I'm going with this. This is fantastic. I'm completely stuck.
Well, I think maybe it's, and we talked about that before, right? These, we were talking about, okay, growth versus degrowth, and is there a right or wrong? But it's, mm-hmm. well, maybe it's, how can we drive the discussion about what is value for society and for the planet? And I'm not saying we need to get rid of growth at all, but maybe we need to add more dimensions of value, because at the moment it's only growth, right? Growth and profit. And how can we drive this discussion to get other values in the same line with growth, with profit maybe?
Yeah, and I think it's about, this is why I try to get the word out, because I think it's the practical application at the coal face of mm-hmm. work and design, where you're actually doing it day to day. That's where we has to fit into for individuals and businesses. So the more that we just play around with it at that space, the more we can fit it into BAU and becomes less of something new and something additional, and and less a bump, but it's just actually part of the process and really streamlined. I think we're just going to get better and better at it, zooming in and out, being, you know, at the moment it's like, oh, we need to have an extra 2 hours to take a systems view, whereas the more that we all do this and share back and improve how that little step works, the more streamlined it will be. You know, we might be able to plug in AI to do it for us a bit, although, you know, we can't use too much AI because that uses a lot of energy and is bad for the environment. So we've just got to be thinking, it's always like, we've always got to think about the bigger picture, the impacts. But yeah, I'd like to think that the more we do it, there's just this more streamlined it's going to be, and the more it becomes just our new BAU.
Yeah. It's shifting it from the exception to the standard.
That's right. Yeah. Like we've done with accessibility. So, and I think we have to go to do it anyway. We're going to be forced to do it if we don't adapt it sooner.
So true. Do you have situations, let's say, where you struggle as a life-centered designer and where you feel like, okay, I'm doing so much, it doesn't all make sense. So does this happen? And if so, what do you do in these situations to get you out of this hole?
I operate in two zones, I guess, or two modes. So I have contract roles. I contract to different projects because I need to make money to make a living. All the life-centered design work, my future scouting work, non-human persona work, I do that in my spare time. I'm a massive design nerd, so I don't mind doing a lot of this in my spare time. Which is great because I'm very really free from a lot of restrictions to explore it. But I'm always looking to see how to bring it into my day-to-day work. Such a challenge. Like as I was saying before, my roles at the moment, everyone's the government, and we're all thinking about vulnerable people and sort of invisible cohorts. That's great. But getting sustainable thinking in there is... there's just so much going on. It's so huge. It's tricky. In a previous role, in a government role, I formed a group, regenerative design group, and we're exploring how to bring this into design, into the government space. So it's a bit of kind of grassroots things that go on that you have to try and find ways in. I guess that's the kind of tension for me is like, okay, I'm doing this in one mode, and the other mode I'm still in the old system, but I kind of like that because it keeps me grounded in reality. Like I don't get caught up in my silo that, you know, everything's going life-centered and great. It's still, you know, I still work in the belly of the beast a lot of the time. But then it's kind of a challenge. How do we get it in there?
I think that's important, right? It is a challenge, and it is, I think people like us, we will do these things for the rest of our lives, right? We won't reach a point where we can say, okay, now we are done. What I was thinking of, and looking at your book, The Life-Centered Design Guide, you are quoting, and I have to read it up, Viktor Papanek, which you say he's one of the maybe pioneers of this idea of life-centered design approach. And so the book is from 1971, and you're quoting him with the following quote: there are professions more harmful than industrial design, but only a few. And possibly only one is phonia, advertising design. So this quote is 50 years old. And still we as designers cause a lot of harm with digital products that we build. Still people like us here need to advocate a lot, right, for more responsible design. Why is that still happening? I mean, I don't want to get too pessimistic here, but it's like, why haven't we made more progress over the last 50 years?
Well, in Australia, we've had 10 years of indecision from a political aspect. Things are better now. But I'm only 51, and I think the problem is a lot older. I can't believe I just said I'm only 51. That was cool.
I got triggered on that sentence as well, as in like, did he just say that?
I did. Yeah. That's a good perspective. Right. But in like, it's a much bigger problem. It's a lot older. It's really, really complex. And I think we often, as humans, we get our hands on new skills long before we know how to use them without causing harm. you know, AI as example. But design wasn't always destructive. Like, design has originated with First Nations people, and they were thinking and doing things, you know, creatively with their tools and their practices and rituals and ways of living, which were sustainable and regenerative. And then, you know, those things kind of got forgotten over time by new groups that were branching out, and there's just a lot more people. So I'm not sure how we can, you know, apply older sustainable ways to larger populations. So I think that's a challenge, is adapting that. And yeah, I think it's just because everything, we're in this system that we've just automated, and it's literally just running and moving so fast, and it's so big, it's hard to shift it. You know, you can evolve it or blow it up, and I'd like to evolve it, but we don't want it to take too long. So yeah, and like, I know myself, like I'm addicted to it. I was raised in this system. I would struggle to survive without it. I've got to develop those skills. So perhaps it's just, yeah, there's so many ways we've got to approach it. We've got to educate the next generations to have skills to not rely on it so much. But yeah, I think I was just going to say, probably one of the big problems is that where a lot of the change needs to happen, where the power needs to happen, that's, there's just so much power there that corrupts people, and it's hard for them to let it go.
Maybe it's one of the challenges is, well, we are operating in constraints, I would say, right? And we need to operate in this constraints or settings, because, well, that's how we work all together. But at some points we need to break this, right? Or let's say break through and change them and maybe shift them. And that's a big difficulty, I think, for us, where do we operate in the boundaries and the constraints that are there by the system, and where do we need to to break them and say, no, this is not okay at all anymore, and we can only change if we change this whole part of the system here, which I think is a big difficulty to see where, yeah, what do I do in which situation, right? And where do we need a big change in the system, and where can we change from, let's say, from the inside and step by step?
Yeah, again, I think it's not either or, is it? It's like doing bits wherever you can. What's your influence if you really care about it? But then again, it's easy to sort of, you know, some people don't have the luxury of choosing their job or where they work, and that, you know, you don't have luxury to challenge things. So again, yeah, I think there's no clear answers, and it's not this or that. It's a bit of a combination, and it's complex, and we'll just do what we can, where we can, and find allies.
Would you describe yourself as hopeful when you look at the future, or more pessimistic on the side? Where do you see yourself?
I'm a realist, but I'm a hopeful realist.
Yeah.
There's a thing called Active Hope. I don't know if you've heard of that. It's a book called Active Hope, and it's about, so it's moving from passive hope to active hope. So passive hope is like, okay, we know things could be better, and we really hope things change, hope the government implement the right policies. And then active hope is where you actually start putting energy into nurturing the things you hope for yourself. And so that's where you go from passive to active hope. And that's, to me, that's like what life-centered design gives us as designers, because suddenly you have tools and mindsets to take what you're worrying about, all this echo anxiety and frustration and anger, and actually turn it into something practical, because you can start representing it in design and including it in its needs and designs, and then innovating on those needs. And suddenly you're doing something active to manifest what you're hoping for, rather than sitting around waiting for it to happen. So I think while I'm a realist, and I am a bit worried about the future in many ways, but then because I'm doing something, it really does, it's therapeutic, and it gives me more hope. and mm-hmm. and positivity.
That was so well said. I really like that you say, yeah, it's, well, we need to get into doing, right? Doing something is always better than doing nothing. And well, we could complain about everything that is going wrong, and it's important to have these discussions, but we need to do something. And it's a long journey, right? It's
it's a way of kind of not being so overwhelmed by the bigger picture. It's like, okay, still going back to what can you do with your influence and skills, and then do something, and suddenly you're part of the solution, and you're not just this passive thing that's part of the problem.
Right. Yes. It's not one massive change. Yeah. It's a massive amount of people making a small change.
Yeah. Ideally, as we said, like they can compound, have compounding impacts.
Yeah, and would you say, I mean, that every single designer can make a change on this world, no matter junior, senior, whatever.
Yeah, that's a good point too. It doesn't matter your experience level, your age. There's things that you can start doing now.
I think that's a perfect ending actually for the podcast here. And I think we could continue talking for one or two more hours. That would be so much more things to discuss. But hey, Damien, thank you so much for joining us here today and for this all these wonderful and really inspiring insights. And as I said, what I personally like so much about your work, there is so much practical stuff that I can just grab from your books and from your website and just take it and use it in my work. And that's really great, what you do for the community here with all the stuff that you build.
Thank you. That's really good to hear, because that's the goal. And so that's great feedback. And thank you for inviting me along today. It's been great to chat to you guys.
Really good discussion. Think so too. So thank you for being with us, and to the people out there, thank you for joining us today and listening to our latest episode. And well, if you like what you heard, please give us a subscription and a rating. You know that. We would highly appreciate. And please have a look at Damien's website, at his books. I deep from my heart, I can say they are worth buying. And in addition, also with buying them, you support a person who spends so much time actually on developing all these tools for us, the design community. And so we put all the links in the show notes. And so coming to an end, it's time to say goodbye to you wonderful people out there. And goodbye, Bavo.
Bye, everyone. See you in the next episode. And remember, lifecenter.design for some practical tips that you can just immediately get started with today.
And so, since the final words always belong to our guest, Damien, do you have any final words or advice for all of us?
Get into it, start experimenting, share it back, and have fun with it. Infuse it with as much joy as you can, because people will feel it.